here, your host for Mac and the Movies, where we look at everything from art house to grindhouse, mainstream to obscure, the forgotten, and the unforgettable. If you missed the recent post on social media, I'll give you a quick update. I needed to table the episodes for Rutger Hauer and Rowdy Roddy Piper for the time being. In their place, I'll be going through the second volume of the Grindhouse Experience from Fortune 5 DVD. There were some great gems in the last collection, but also quite a bit of bad as well. Will Volume 2 feature anything as horrible as Tortured Angels or Women's Camp 119? Well, we'll find out. Let's get into the movies. Detective Saita's sister, Luis, is murdered in front of a group of people. His investigation takes him through the seedy underbelly of Montreal. The deeper he gets into his investigation, the more he realizes his sister wasn't as innocent as he thought. Blazing Magnum, aka Strange Shadows in an Empty Room, features a wonderful, insane mix of set pieces. A fight with transvestites, a decent foot chase, an underrated car chase, and a hard-boiled lead in the tradition of Sam Spade and Popeye Doyle. This is how you start a box set. This is putting one's best foot forward with regard to piecing together a collection of films. Blazing Magnum is an excellent choice for introducing people to the kind of films featured on 42nd Street. I first became aware of this film from a raggedy catalog for the now-defunct Blackest Heart Media back in the early 2000s. They advertised in the back pages of Fangoria, among others. This catalog introduced me to the likes of Joe D'Amato, Bruno Mattei, Umberto Lenzi, Lucio Fulci, and Dario Argento. This catalog was my first exposure to the grotesquely fantastic world of Italian horror. Although they currently live on, as of this recording, in the form of Rotten Cotton, where you can find some fantastic cult film t-shirts. The blurb in the catalog painted the film as a car chase action film featuring a number of top talent. It wouldn't be until 10 years later, around 2013 or 2014, that I actually saw the trailer for Blazing Magnum. It was wall-to-wall action and intrigue, like one would expect from any trailer of the time. I knew right then I wanted to see this film. In fact, it was this film that made me shell out to the $3 out of pocket, the rest paid for by a gift card, to buy this volume of the Grindhouse Experience. So I was looking at 20 movies for $3. That's a steal. After all that time of anticipation, did Blazing Magnum deliver? Yes. Yes, it did. However, it has to be noted that the film is nowhere near as action-packed as the trailer would suggest. There were a lot of talking scenes pertaining to Saita's investigation, but the little action there is in the context of the whole film is well worth watching for. It's an attempt to mix a giallo-light murder mystery with the gritty cop films akin to The French Connection and 7-Ups. Director Alberto De Martino was credited under the pseudonym Martin Herbert. Now, the name may not be immediately recognizable, but you're probably familiar with one film he directed. For all the flack people give him for Puma Man, Blazing Magnum shows he can make a really good film. Vincenzo Tomasi, Italy's favorite editor, handled the cutting of this film. His resume reads like a who's who of Italian genre cinema. Lucio Fulci's Zombie, as well as all three entries of the Gates of Hell trilogy, Cannibal Holocaust for Ruggero Deodato, and George Grau's Let Sleeping Corpses Lie. The music by Armando Travaglioli is a highlight. mixing the orchestral of Bernard Herrmann with the funk rock of Maurizio and Guido De Angelis. A jazzy track like The Puzzle Is Complete emphasizes the mystery element. The best track by far is the main theme, which hits you from the get-go and doesn't let up. Credit is owed to Tom Sutton, who was in charge of the stunts for the film. There's a tense foot chase through a subway station. The fight between Saita and the transvestites might raise some eyebrows. The car chase set piece in the last third of the film is fantastic. You've got a 1971 Ford Mustang and a 1968 Buick Special, both taking a beating in the chase, which lasts for a good 8 or 9 minutes. No surprise considering it's under the supervision of Remy Julien. We covered previously High Crime, Watch Out We're Mad, as well as Mean Frank and Crazy Tony, where he provided the stunt coordination. His stunt work is impeccable. Italian Job Blade Runner producer Michael Dealey once said, "You want the best, you hire the best. Remy Julien is the best." Stuart Whitman plays the role of Detective Saita. He's a cross of Harry Callahan and Popeye Doyle. He bends the law but gets results. Saita comes off as cold, but that may be his way of coping with his sister's death. Whitman has a gruff look that was perfect for Westerns. He found a second career in B-movies like Night of the Lepus, Tobe Hooper's Eaten Alive, and 1980's The Monster Club. John Saxon plays Sergeant Matthews, who was helping Saita with his investigation. Saxon is terribly underused in this film. This man is an exploitation icon. Enter the Dragon, Cannibal Apocalypse, Black Christmas, Tenebrae, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Such an amazing talent. Martin Landau plays a director having an affair with Luis. He does a fine job as a target for Saita's contempt. Other than North by Northwest and a few episodes of the old school Mission Impossible, this is probably the youngest I've ever seen him. This is a long ways away from his Oscar-winning turn as Bela Lugosi in Burton's Ed Wood. Tisa Farrow plays a blind music teacher who lived with Luis. She gives one of the more convincing blind performances I've seen in a film. Horror fans will know her from Lucio Fulci's Zombie and Joe D'Amato's Anthropophagus. Carol Lori has a small but pivotal role as Saita's sister. Blazing Magnum is the proper way to start a box set. You get some decent action, an intriguing mystery, an awesome music score, and a solid cast of character actors. It'll be interesting to see if the other films in the collection can reach this height. Is a professional poker player, living a life of luxury in Paris, France. One night, on his way to a game, he finds a car veered off the road. He checks the car to find a man inside, wounded badly. Michael doesn't realize this man was shot and left for dead. Michael takes the man to a nearby hospital. He leaves after the man is registered. When the shot wounds are discovered, the doctor suspects Michael was the one who shot him. Meanwhile, assassins witness Michael helping their target and now go after him. Three Men to Kill is a nice take on the wrong man trope made famous by Alfred Hitchcock. To Catch a Thief, The Wrong Man, North by Northwest, Strangers on a Train, all classics from Hitchcock's filmography. What makes Three Men to Kill stand out is the moral ambiguity of the main character, Michael. He's not afraid to defend himself, violently if so. Meanwhile, a character like Roger Thornhill was more likely to use his wits to get out of a situation. This film is more daring. There are some shots of quick violence, notably a bloody headshot, occasional nudity. In the Hitchcockian tradition, there is a constant sense of tension. My biggest problem is that this was clearly a transfer from a VHS to a DVD. The screen would snow up, and I searched for the tracking on my console's DVD options. Rarely did I run into this problem with the previous Grindhouse experience, and I worry this may be the norm for the other films. The Finnish subtitles often got in the way of some sequences. The film was directed by Jacques Doret. Honestly, I'm not familiar at all with his other films. The music score by Claude Bolling lacks a memorable melody. There were five writers, yet the film doesn't feel like a committee project. Remy Julien handles the car stunt action, although there's only about 2 to 3 minutes of such action. There is a chase in Paris at the 41-minute mark, which features a nice reverse 180 in a confined space. Alain Delon plays Michael. One could say he was being typecast in the wake of his star-making turn in Les Samouraïs. Yet he had a boldness and charm about him that recalls Connery's turn as James Bond. I don't recall seeing Michael being unsure of a situation or a predicament, which may send signals to some members of the audience not to care about the situation. Three Men to Kill is a decent thriller. Imagine a wrong man thriller from Alfred Hitchcock if he didn't have to deal with those pesky film censors. Delon is fine in the lead role, but it's neither spectacular nor a bore.
Who are you working for?
We don't know.
Whoever he is, I suggest you tell him I take orders from no one. No punks like you, not the Colonel, not even Washington. Nobody.
Yeah, okay, we got it.
We got the message.
If I see either of you two, this is where I take them.
Graves is the spy enjoying his retirement. He's visited by an associate who offers him an assignment, to which Graves refuses. The visit puts him on the radar of some nasty people. A pair of mobsters warn him not to get involved, which only makes Graves want to be involved. It turns out the plans for a solar shuttle were stolen. First, the ransom was a meager $50,000, but when someone realized what they had, the ransom jumped to $50 million. Graves must go in and get the plans before the shuttle can be used for sinister means. Tools at his disposal include a belt that can conceal a knife and a grenade disguised as a cigarette. With Mr. Deathman, actor and writer David Broadnax tried to make a blaxploitation James Bond film, but it fails to match similar films featuring the likes of Fred the Hammer Williamson or Jim Kelly. It's a very shoddy production, often with boom mics and camera and substandard action sequences. They don't even have a credit for the music composer. The synth funk score is one of the few highlights I can point to here.
Than I do, so we'll play it your way.
Similar to Three Men to Kill, there are some tracking issues which gives away this DVD as a bad VHS transfer. The movie poster for Mr. Deathman is one of the most misleading I have ever seen. I'll use it as the thumbnail for this episode. Take a look at it. Who do you think that is supposed to be on the cover with Broadnax? Pam Grier, right? Well, she doesn't even remotely appear in this film. Michael D. Moore directed this film. He's better known for being a second unit director. Credits with that role include the 1953 War of the Worlds, the biblical epic The Ten Commandments, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Patton, the Indiana Jones trilogy, and yes, it's only a trilogy, and Ghostbusters 2, among others. This guy was a big deal, so for him to agree to direct this film, he must have been either friends with Broadnax or he had some spare time between gigs. Even before watching Mr. Deathman, I had some beef with David Broadnax. I had the misfortune of seeing Zombie Island Massacre. With a title like that, you expect some gory zombie mayhem. For starters, there are no zombies. Imagine a movie being hyped as a zombie movie, and it doesn't deliver on any zombies. Second, it plays out like a murder mystery. I'm sure Troma paid next to nothing to get their hands on this one. Keep an eye out for actor James Ryan as one of the Mafia lackeys. You might know him from Space Mutiny as Chief Engineer McPherson.
Gentlemen, it seems that we are not all in agreement. Engineer Parsons seems content to spend his remaining years upon the Southern Sun.
Yeah. Then let him do so alone.
Yeah, sure.
This is mutiny. This is treason, which I warn you I must report.
Will you allow him to spoil your ambitions for a greater future?
Allow that.
Okay, I'm done with this one. Mr. Deathman is an uninteresting footnote in blaxploitation. There are far better movies to be seen, and so far this is the worst of the box set. The slave trade in East Africa is in its twilight in the late 19th century. Two rival slave traders engage in a violent conflict over what little profits remain. Much like other films of the time, be it Goodbye Uncle Tom or Mandingo, Slavers offers an unflinching depiction of the slave trade. The presentation of the natives borders on sick caricature. African tribesmen help slavers capture members of rival tribes. To the film's credit, it does feature a great score by Erhard Schoner. The movie doesn't hold back on the violence. Groin stabbings, decapitations, slaves used for target practice, a baby gets curb stomped. It would be too much for many a viewer. The film already tackled controversial material, but incidents during production added to that infamy. Horses died when the pyrotechnics detonated. The actual actors were used in place of stunt performers. I can't help but wonder whose brilliant idea it was to pair this film with Mr. Deathman on the Grindhouse Experience Volume 2 collection. I was intrigued by the casting in this film. There is some great talent here, and I wouldn't be surprised if they signed on thinking this was some somber, serious period piece and not an exploitative take on the slave trade. Jürgen Gosler is both actor and director for this film. He plays Max von Erken, slave trader and jealous husband to Anna von Erken. Anna is played by the lovely Britt Eklund. Eklund starred in The Man with the Golden Gun, The Wicker Man, and the original Get Carter. Trevor Howard plays Alec McKenzie, the rival to von Erken. Despite his old age, McKenzie is still trying to reap wealth from the slave trade. Howard enjoyed a lengthy career with such films as Mutiny on the Bounty, The Third Man, and even Richard Donner's Superman. Ron Eli plays Steve Hamilton, a business-minded individual. He has one of the more interesting subplots of the film. He supports the slave trade until he himself is in chains. White or black, it doesn't matter to a slave trader if money is to be made. This experience changes Hamilton's mind. Ray Milland plays Hassan, an Arab slave trader and mercenary. If there weren't enough red flags, Milland is the biggest one in the film. A Welsh actor playing an Arab. Questionably amusing to say the least. Milland ran the gamut of quality to exploitation. He worked under Alfred Hitchcock in Dial M for Murder. He was also in the Nature's Revenge film Frogs and The Thing with Two Heads. But you have to admit, he has the best headshot of any actor on the Internet Movie Database. Ken Gampu plays Musulma. Oh, I forgot to mention, he was also in Mr. Deathman. He was a generic henchman, which may explain why I don't remember him. In Slavers, he plays the head of a tribe working with Hassan, and it's another forgettable turn. I'm not saying this is him being a bad actor. I'm sure he was just poorly directed. Rounding out the cast is the one and only Cameron... Mitchell. Mitchell is De Silva, a Mexican associate of the slave traders. Why is this a problem? Mitchell isn't Mexican or remotely Spanish. Despite being entertaining as all hell in other films, Mitchell gives a very subdued performance in Slavers. This is not the Cameron Mitchell we'll see in Deadly Prey.
Who am I? A little man who spent 27 years of his life as a cop trying to put big shots like you away. 27 years in the filth and the dirt of the street, and there ain't no music down there. You watch the people in the streets killing, raping each other, pumping dope through their veins while big men like you sit in the fancy penthouses and let the poor slobs rot in hell. I know about you.
Terror in Beverly Hills.
Yes, I'm watching the goddamn news. What are you watching, a porno movie?
Or the Toolbox Murders.
L-O-L-L-I-P-O-P spells lollipop.
I bought you a lollipop.
Nice.
This movie is rough viewing. It's shocking. The main characters are unappealing. The subject matter is distasteful and executed in such a manner. It has more going for it than Mr. Deathman, but that isn't saying a whole hell of a lot. And with this part done, we'll go ahead and rank the film so far in the second volume of the Grindhouse Experience, as difficult as this was. We did it for the last volume, so we'll keep this tradition going. In last place, Mr. Deathman. Third, Slavers. Second, Three Men to Kill. And in first place, Blazing Magnum. And I have a feeling it's going to be Blazing Magnum is the film to beat. And that wraps up this episode of Mac and the Movies. Thanks for listening. Next time, we continue our journey through Volume 2 of the Grindhouse Experience. We have a double feature of post-apocalyptic films, Striker and the Atlantis Interceptors, plus a double feature of sword and sandal films, Carthage in Flames and Coriolanus. Feel free to leave a comment and reach out to me on social media. I'm on Facebook and Twitter. Send me any questions via my Gmail account. If you would like to see this program grow, feel free to give a one-time donation via PayPal. All info in the description. Until next time, this is Mackenzie Lambert from Mac and the Movies. Take care, folks.
On the location of the call, Lenny.
We'll put a trace on it.
Harder.
A super trace.
Give me that damn phone. Get a fucking super trace. Asshole.